Thank God for Michigan. Those were the words of President Abraham Lincoln as he watched Michigan men arrive by train in the early days of the American Civil War. Michigan soldiers were the first to make their way east from the western states. The state of Michigan sent 90,000 men to war, nearly a quarter of our male population. About one in six died in service. The entire first graduating class of the Michigan Agricultural College was excused early so that they could join the Union Army. Life and Death in the Civil War is currently on display in the exhibition Michigan in the Civil War at the MSU Museum. The exhibit marks the ongoing sesquicentennial of the war between the states. Drawn from the museum's historic collection, Michigan in the Civil War highlights our state's connections to America's bloodiest conflict. Uniforms, weapons, camp goods, medical equipment, even some surviving Civil War hardtack are all included. WKAR's Peter Wharf joined MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater for a look at Michigan in the Civil War. Rosentrater began the tour by examining some of the tools of war and describing the Michigan fighting man.
Michigan has had a lot of cavalrymen, per capita more cavalrymen than any other northern state. And this particular weapon, the Sharps, or some of the other carbines that were out there, allowed, Spencer is another carbine they've got on display, it allowed them greater firepower.
Why was it that Michigan had a larger percentage of cavalrymen?
You know, that's a great question. Maybe we didn't like to walk as much. I'm not exactly sure why we had more, but it may have been. At the outset of the war, the federal government didn't want volunteer cavalrymen. They said there's no way you can train or outfit a cavalryman as a volunteer. And again, the war was going to be short, and we weren't going to need to go through this very intense process of training cavalrymen. Obviously, that changes. And part of Michigan's situation may have been certain folks back home who took the initiative. There was a congressman from Grand Rapids by the name of Kellogg, for example, who worked very hard, got permission from the War Department, organized several regiments of cavalry. And four of them would ultimately be formed into a brigade. That was a rarity to have four from the same state. And they would fight in the Eastern Theater, most prominently at the Battle of Gettysburg, under the command of a new brigadier general by the name of George Custer. So, again, firepower, the ability to move, and horses clearly allow them to move, but what they did in the Civil War a lot wasn't these grandiose cavalry fights with swords. There are swords on display here as well. It was generally you take your cavalrymen and you got them to a location. Three men would allow their horses to be held by a fourth man while those three use their additional firepower like you've got here in a Spencer or a various carbines, and you've got the ability to move. That was the whole idea. You could get to a particular place fairly quickly, and then you've got additional firepower. And that works to their advantage by mid-war, and then clearly a distinct advantage as we move into the latter part of the war. The South suffering from a loss of horses, for example, not as able to replace them as the North was able to. Here's another artifact here, Harris Hillard's 3rd Cavalry Decorative Box. The reason I noticed it here is it talks about at the end of the war, because what happens, getting back to Michigan cavalrymen, is when the war is over, as was normally the case, you know, the Southerners go home to the destruction that's been left behind. Well, Northerners said, we won the war, we want to come home. And most of them did come home. There were some exceptions, though. One group of exceptions was the Michigan Cavalry Brigade, because they were sent west to deal with what was then perceived as an Indian problem, right? And we need veteran, skilled cavalrymen. So you can imagine these guys, they'd just gone through the Grand March in late May of 1865 in Washington, and they're going home, or so they think. And as they make that train trip, when they get to St. Louis, Missouri, and the train's not turning north, and no one's told them, by the way, you know, we're just getting on the train, boys. So they finally end up in the Dakota Territories, and they spent about the next 6 to 9 months out west taking casualties and doing a part of what they were supposed to do, which was to protect settlers from the Indian threat, or the perceived Indian threat, as it were. Then to show you the gratitude the government had when they finally mustered them out, they said, all right, you guys can go home now. Good luck. And they didn't make provision for them to come home, so they ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they had to fortunately the Michigan congressional delegation was able to find some money and bring them home. Otherwise, they'd probably still be there, or maybe they would have settled in Utah for all I know. But I thought it was a little bit unfair to say, you know, we're going to make you stay in. I mean, they were in the Army. They had to stay. I mean, they couldn't just go home. they certainly were not excited at all. They had joined up to fight the Confederates, not to fight the Sioux.
That's an amazing story that probably not many people know, that these were soldiers who thought the war was over. They were put on a train, assuming they were on their way home, and then they were taken out west to fight Indians.
Yeah. And again, it was quite a shock, I'm sure, to them to suddenly say, okay. And they were fairly disgruntled, as you might imagine. Matter of fact, there are a number of instances of guys deserting. I mean, as soon as a boat stopped somewhere, and they had already been told at this point, they immediately got, and they in some cases they were not allowed off the boat, you know, because they went up the Missouri River. That's where the boat comes into, and they say, well, we're not letting guys off because in the previous stops, whenever we get off, people don't come back.
Yeah. So, Roger Rosentrater's history professor at Michigan State University. We're touring the exhibit today, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary at the Michigan State University Museum. Can we step over here to something that might be very familiar to people who are interested in the Civil War? It's one of the smallest items in the display and in any Civil War display, but probably has one of the greatest impacts throughout the war and throughout the history of war.
Right. Well, you're looking at a mini ball, and it was named after its French inventor, Claude Monet. Now, we can't say Monet as Americans, so we had to call it mini, but it is the .58 caliber cartridge that was used in your basic Civil War musket. And there is a cartridge, a paper cartridge below that, which shows you, and if you were to open that, there would be black powder in there as well as that particular bullet. So if you take the Springfield, which is up here on display, there is a ramrod, and what you have to do is go through a 9-step process to load this thing. And we can't do it on the radio, but nevertheless, you have to take the cartridge, you got to tear the cartridge, you got to put the powder in, you got to ram the powder, put the bullet in, ram the bullet in. Then you have to put the ramrod back because you're going to need it again, right? Then you have to put a cartridge, a percussion cap, as it were, near the base of the rifle, and then you're ready to fire. I mean, and it's if you're really good, you are supposed to be able to do this 3 times a minute. It's pretty mind-boggling, I think, when I think about the process involved.
I can't imagine doing that fast while on a battlefield with guys shooting at me.
No, and that's a very good point. You know, people are shooting at you. And there's a very interesting scene in the movie Glory, which some of the listeners would have certainly have seen, where one of the young recruits is firing away, and suddenly the officer, Matthew Broderick, comes up and...
Attention, company!
As you were. You're a good shot, Private.
Thank you, sir. Squirrel hunting.
You ever killed a man?
No, sir.
But you're handy with a gun.
Yes, sir.
Reload. Faster! Faster! Discharge your weapon. Do it! Now do it again, only this time, I want it done quickly. Faster! Reload! Faster!
And he's firing the pistol in his ear because he's saying, hey, this is the distraction you have to deal with.
And he's saying faster and faster while shooting in the soldier's ear.
You know, as opposed to, oh, yeah, I'm just kind of shooting bottles or whatever. Now, the range of this particular bullet, because it's rifled, the barrel of the rifle is got grooves in it. And that allows this bullet to travel accurately about 400 to 500 yards. Why that's important is that the tactics haven't kept up with the weaponry. And if you can start, as I explained to my students, if you can start hitting people at 3 or 4 football fields and you're marching, not necessarily running, even if you're loading slowly, you can do a pretty good job and a lot of damage.
The tactics were based on older methods that weren't taking into account a more accurate weapon.
Well, a smoothbore musket has a range of maybe 100 yards. So think 1 football field. So if I can still, and it still gets loaded somewhat similarly, so if I can load it once, crossing 100 yards, or again, as I tell my students, how quickly can you run that 100-yard dash? Now, they didn't run a lot in the Civil War. They marched because having that massed firepower was very important. But you can still cover 100 yards fairly quickly. And again, if you've got bayonets and there's a lot of you, you're going to intimidate the guy at the other end, even if he's got the first shot off. But at 4 or 5 football fields, that's a whole different process.
He's still far away.
He is, and again, that's a long distance to try to travel, and you can get several rounds off. And again, if the idea is massing, I mean, bringing together literally hundreds, if not thousands, of rifles at one time and then firing fairly routinely, again, covering that terrain is almost impossible. If you think about the Battle of Fredericksburg, for example, the Yankees covered about a 500 to 600 yard open field. The Confederates were at the top behind a stone wall. There were several thousands of them at that stone wall so that someone could load and hand a weapon, so they didn't have to even load themselves if they were in the front rank. But the point being is that after 14 continuous charges, the Yankees never got any closer than 40 yards.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.